You Have Always Been the Place by Cobalt Kicks. Read by CookieMom6067. Niccolo's heard tell of the purifying fire of rebirth. He has imagined soft white flames of God's light that will score him clean and set him complete, understanding, back on earth. But now he knows what rebirth is. It is the grisly pop of his joints realigning, the desperate clammy reeling of his innards back into his fanned-out ribcage, the searing of his skin racing back together, his splintered bones twisting into place. It is gruesome. It is pain. And always it is Yusuf. Life crashes over him like an ocean wave. The water slides and coalesces, surges and washes down his spine. And then it is no longer water. It becomes thick heat, matted hair, grit grinding between his teeth. Niccolo comes back to life, dry with dust and sticky with blood. His stomach spits out the dagger. It drops onto the ground beside him. He is lying belly up under the blanket of the night sky. When the pain recedes and he can think, he can see stars. Yes, stars innumerable. So this is still Earth, he thinks, lifting a hand, dirty and streaked with blood, but perfectly intact. It seems very pale in the starlight. God has remade him whole. Beside him, someone stirs. Niccolo turns his head. The twisted, bloody abdomen of the infidel reforms itself around Niccolo's longsword. Niccolo breathes in guttural shock. Him as well? Hadn't this been his task? Why would he be brought back as well? Hatred runs in rivulets through Niccolo, forms a stream, drenches him in anger. The man groans. It sounds pained, confused, human. The man opens his eyes. They are dark, studded with starlight. Two worlds join in Niccolo, the world that has never seen this face before, and the world in which this man has been imprinted on Niccolo's dreams for years. He gazes dazedly at Niccolo for a moment, and then his face hardens. Niccolo staggers to his feet, grasping for the spear lying on the stones beside him. Across from him, the infidel does the same, readies his curved blade smeared with blood, Niccolo's blood. They lunge for one another at the same time. They are the only moving things on the battlefield, but Niccolo wouldn't call them living. The infidel cuts Niccolo's neck. Niccolo pierces his chest. They tumble together off the city walls. His tormentor embeds a spear in Niccolo's back. Niccolo splits his skull with a stone. The night flickers into daytime. How many? The infidel fights, like air moves, sometimes holding still little more than the shuddering heat of a mirage, sometimes a gale that breaks ships upon cliffs. Niccolo learns very fast. The sixth or seventh time, he blocks a strike that has killed him twice before and returns the favor. The man chokes on his own blood, arms pulling ineffectually at Niccolo's foot where it is planted on his chest. His fingers go slack, and his hands slide down to his own chest over the shredded remains of his armor. Please, he is reduced to begging. Please let him stay dead this time. Please. What was it for, if not to kill him? There is silence, but not the holy kind. The only thing near to Niccolo is corpses, and under his skin are corpses all the more. The silence stretches from Niccolo to the man on the ground, still. A hand twitches over the man's stopped heart. Niccolo sinks to his knees beside the body. Exhaustion swarms him like a cloud of flies. He lets his head roll back towards the blossoming dawn. He doesn't want to stop. He doesn't want to sleep. Because what if this was not the cure? What if he has traveled this far and brutalized and killed so many, and there will still never be another night where his dreams don't sing and shout and beg him to find this man?
Lissa Maritan Ucha Mi Valika,
the man rasps. He is frowning, eyes shut. as if he does not want to open them. Niccolo understands. He reaches for his sword. They kill each other once more before the army returns. Niccolo opens his eyes, brushes the grime and the dust from his eyelashes. He raises his cheek from where it has been pressed into the earth. He is lying on his side, his body curved towards his opponent. Familiar eyes meet Niccolo's gaze. The man reaches for Niccolo. Niccolo doesn't flinch. Very softly, two fingers alight on Niccolo's jugular, where the skin burns like a torch flame mending itself. The pain fizzles, becoming a candle, a sunbeam, nothing. Niccolo cannot look away from the other man. On the horizon, a great many people are moving. Suddenly, the man is on his feet, speaking in his waterfall speech. Niccolo blinks up at him. The sun makes the man's black, curling hair into a halo. The man clicks his tongue with such a clear expression of impatience that Niccolo feels the corners of his mouth gently press upwards, despite himself. The man bends towards Niccolo. He still doesn't flinch, and pulls him up to stand. Together they stagger away from the heaped bodies. They don't pause until the city walls have disappeared behind them. They make it into a valley and follow a dried riverbed as the sounds of battle and siege are swallowed up by the arid hills. It is during this walk that Niccolo first thinks, "I am not like them anymore. I have become something else." His countrymen and fellow Christians died when they bled that much, and he, well, he watches the dark-haired man pick his way over the stones. The two of them had become all alone together. The man catches him looking. Niccolo tries and coughs. His throat has been re-knit so many times. He puts a hand over his chest, covering the blood-stained cross, and says, "Niccolo." "Niccolo," the man repeats. The way he watches Niccolo reminds him of someone looking at the sun, face drawn together, letting in only the most bearable edge of light. He gestures to himself and says, "Yusuf." "Yosef?" Yusuf huffs, and Niccolo thinks, "But it is all right. I will try again," and wonders how he is so sure. He wonders if this could possibly be the work of the divine hand. He has been set messily down on a new trajectory. He doesn't know where it leads, but it seems to curve around Yusuf. "Yusuf, Yusuf," his name weighs on Niccolo's tongue. It feels like an incorporeal string was woven between them when they exchanged their names. Niccolo is suddenly worried he will never be able to move too far away from this man. Niccolo makes them pause under one of the spiny, broad-crowned trees at noon. They sink to the ground with their backs to the bark. Niccolo undoes his scabbard and presses it to his chest and sinks into a black and dreamless sleep. He is standing apart from Yusuf and the villagers, watching as his companion tries to barter Niccolo's blood-crusted chainmail for food and clothes, when something prickles at the back of his skull. There is nothing else to do in the lifeless afternoon, so he follows the feeling, the mounting tension, tugging at it until it snaps taut. Then the shouting starts. Niccolo takes off, running through the clustered houses until he sees them, the familiar banner of the cross still in the dry air. There are 10 or so of them. One of them has an arrow notched. Their arrogance crackles in the air. A single father holds out a shaking hoe with one arm, the other flung out between the pilgrims and his family. "Wait!" Niccolo shouts without thinking. They look in his direction, earning the villagers a fragile moment. He walks forward until he is standing between the villagers and the invaders. "I," Niccolo begins, and then something barrels into him. He sprawls in the dust and scrabbles to his feet in time to see Yusuf, a pale-fletched arrow protruding from his heart, topple over sideways. There is no hesitation. Niccolo draws his sword and goes to work. When he is done, he sticks his long sword in the dirt and leans on it, gasping. The family had hidden in the closest house when the blood began flowing, so their secret is safe. His side stings where he's been impaled by a blunt knife. He can't quite believe he's become the kind of person who bitterly wishes his enemies would bother to sharpen their weapons before goring him open with them. Yusuf will laugh about it. Yusuf. Nicola casts about for him. He's still crumpled on his side. Blood has pooled under him, no longer flowing since his heart stopped. Nicola staggers over and kneels by him. He rolls him onto his back. Yusuf's head lolls, eyes dull as pebbles. Nicola has never been so familiar with another man's corpse. He draws the knife that Yusuf carries from his belt and cuts the arrow out. It comes free with a wet sound, and Nicola flings it away. Then he waits. He taps Yusuf's knuckles to get him to stir. Time becomes a dry trickle. When moments have passed, or maybe hours, or maybe years, and Yusuf has still not moved, the first flicker of unease gutters underneath Nicola's ribs. Something is wrong. In the months of traveling together, slowly piecing together parts of one another's languages, their separate lives, this was the first time one of them had died since the battle outside Jerusalem's walls. Nicola's gaze lands on the arrow. The shaft is smeared red and the sand clings to the sticky darkness. Panic coils in him like thunder heard distantly from over the horizon. All those other times, he realizes, Yusuf had died by his hand, by his alone. What if there had been something, a mutual understanding between them? Nicola has felt its soft turnings in his chest, ruffling, something softly beating at a cage. Wake up, he hisses to Yusuf. That part of him has gone abruptly still. Wake up, he says again, none too gently. Yusuf's back bows off the ground. He groans, high and pained, face drawn in tightly. He opens his eyes. They land on Nicola, not really seeing him, then flicker across the sky, the bodies, the empty village square, then back up to Nicola. You killed them. Nicola nods. Then the chained, hushed thing in Nicola's chest, the thing that had gone limp and quiet when Yusuf died, comes back to life with violence, ripping itself free from its restraints. Nicola gasps. What is it? Yusuf asks, surprise thickening his accent. It's so familiar. Nicola's eyes burn. He buries his face in his hands. What? Yusuf demands. He grabs one of Nicola's wrists, pulls it away from his face with surprising strength for someone who had been beyond the veil of life only a minute ago. Nicola, what? There is no way to lie. I just thought, maybe, if it wasn't me who... Oh, Yusuf says. He releases Nicola's wrist. Nicola nods, gets up, and starts brushing down his clothes with a little more meticulousness than is strictly necessary. He's aware he looks ridiculous, picking off grains of sand when they're damp with Yusuf's dark blood, but can't stop himself. I didn't think of that, Yusuf says. He leverages himself up onto his elbows. Nicola says, you took your time to come back. I'm sorry, Yusuf says slowly. It won't happen again. It's a joke. Clearly a joke. Yusuf wants Nicola to smile at him, but he refuses to. Instead, he nods stiffly. See that you don't, he says, and marches away to gather their belongings, meaning to leave before any more Christians return. He dreams of a thick forest, the greenery dripping wet, every tree trunk a moss bed. He dreams of a campfire, damp wood, spitting steam and sparks. An axe lies close to a curled hand. Wood shavings litter the ground. He is looking into the eyes of a dark-haired woman with bright teeth and knows she is incomprehensibly old and doesn't know how he knows this. Nicola jerks awake, and each ragged breath of bitter desert air burns. Yusuf sits bolt upright on the other mat. His eyes flicker to Nicola, not really seeing him, then around the dark walls of the house and back to Nicola. His pupils expand in the blackness. He exhales.
We are safe, Nicola says.
Yusuf squeezes his eyes shut and leans back against the wall. When he opens them, he's squinting at Nicola.
If we find them, he says, voice hoarse with sleep, do you think the dreams will stop? Like they did when I found you.
Nicola presses his lips together.
I saw a forest, he says, instead of lying.
There is no way to say he dreams of Yusuf in another way altogether these days. Yusuf rubs a finger over his lower lip.
I saw a fire. Someone was making arrows
with black feathers.
It could be anywhere, Nicola sighs.
He taps his fingers in thought. Not anywhere, Yusuf says. North.
I think I can feel it, Nicola says, because he can. Like a lodestone on water.
Yusuf looks at him across the room.
I just mean it was too wet to be near here.
It's dark, but he can picture Yusuf's exasperated, warm expression.
All right, he says. We go north.
They work in Tripoli for a while, scraping together coin for passage across the sea, and by the time the ship they boarded has cast away, the gentle, feathered thing in Nicola's chest has made itself a home there.
It seems to feed on the scraps of stories Yusuf tells him about his home, his colorful and unusual language, his bright, rushing impatience, the way he clicks his tongue when something moves too slowly, how he's quick to anger, quicker to laugh.
By the time the ship docks, Nicola is surprised there is any space left for air in his chest. It is not helped by the string between them seeming to become shorter and shorter. It pulls closer and closer. After 5 years, Nicola realizes there is a word for this feeling. After 10 years, he does something about it. They find the women from their dreams in a place that will come to be known as the Forest of the White Tower. Nicola knows they are quite dangerous, are him and Yusuf, invulnerable as they are, and with their years of practice, when they fight back to back, Nicola would call them lethal. This, he learns, is child's play compared to Andromache and Quinn. When Andromache and Quinn move in together, death gods of every denomination hide their faces. The storm has been swelling on the horizon since noon, and at dusk, the tight membrane of the sky cannot hold it back any longer. It splits like a burst lip, and rain comes down in violent, angry lashes. Nicola drags Yusuf by the hand at a staggering run along the forest road until they reach the monastery ruins, the sound of Yusuf's delighted laughter in concert with the dark, desperate growls of thunder. They burst through the broken door and collapse against the cloister pillars. Nicola is gasping for air. With effort, he rolls his head to the side and sees through the wet, plastered-down fringe of his hair that Yusuf is still smiling. Nicola's eyes slide closed, the corners of his mouth turning up without his meaning to.
You still like storms so much after centuries, Nicola says between gulps of air. It amazes me.
A few feet away, where the sheltering overhang of the cloister ends, rain pours in a stream into the courtyard. Nicola helps Yusuf to struggle out of his drenched through wool cloak, letting it fall to the flagstones. A white whip of lightning cracks the evening. Above them, the wine-purple clouds finally blanket the last few rays of the orange sunset. Yusuf holds out his hand in the rain, and Nicola stands, dripping on the abandoned flagstones, watching him. Yusuf likes thunderstorms and the night sky, and standing on a ship in the middle of the ocean on a cloudy day when the horizon is lost somewhere between the clear water and the aquatic sky and the pillars of clouds. Infinite things don't frighten him. He has explained it to Nicola many times before. I like to feel small, to feel like I am part of something vast. I feel like I am in it, and it is in me, under my skin.
You know, Nicola says, there is something here you should see.
As always, Yusuf turns to him with the surety of a compass needle swinging north. Nicola levels his gaze at him. Yusuf reaches out, hooks two fingers in Nicola's sleeve, and tugs. Nicola stumbles a step forward, feeling too heavy, and tired to resist.
"Is it something I'll like?" Yusuf asks.
"I hope so," Niccolo says.
Yusuf takes a handful of Niccolo's dripping cloak in his other hand and pulls Niccolo forward another step.
"You hope so. You don't know."
"I said already, you still amaze me."
"Oh, good," Yusuf says, sliding his hand up the front of Niccolo's cloak. Water sluices out of the fabric over his hand. "I wouldn't want to bore you." He reels Niccolo in another step until he can reach around the back of Niccolo's neck and pull their foreheads together. Niccolo collides chest to chest with Yusuf, pressing him back against the cloister pillar. Niccolo exhales, leaning into him.
"We should dry off first."
"Inshallah, there will be some dry firewood in the stores." Niccolo nods.
"Let's go and see."
Niccolo manages to coax the fire into being on the rectory floor, making sure to leave some wood for the next travelers seeking shelter who pass through, and they spread their outer clothes out to dry next to it. The storm shows no signs of letting up. He circles the room once, decides the doorway poses most danger, and lays down on that side of Yusuf. Yusuf learned to stop protesting this around the sixth or seventh decade.
"This is it," Niccolo says, and points his chin towards the ceiling.
Yusuf looks up, his eyes glowing.
"Oh, Nico," he says, laying down next to him, close enough that Niccolo can feel the warmth radiating through his damp shirt sleeves, but not touching.
Above them, the gray rectory walls give way to a delicate and dramatic mural.
"It's beautiful."
It is easy to get lost in this art, and they do. After a while, Yusuf asks, voice quiet,
"Do you feel close to God here?"
"I used to," Niccolo says.
"I used to, before I met you."
On the cool floor between them, Yusuf stretches out his fingers, so that his little finger brushes against Niccolo's.
"I confuse righteousness with holiness."
These days, Niccolo finds, he feels the thrum of divinity when they listen to the stories of the sailors they meet at the harbor, when he quietly peels Yusuf oranges after dinner, as Andromache and Quinn bicker over an event from centuries past, in the aftermath of action, when they restore people whose lives they've saved back to their families.
"But as you know, you taught a different way to be close to God, with actions."
Yusuf takes his hand. Niccolo has oscillated around religion for centuries and has come to settle somewhere not quite wrathful, not quite peaceful. It doesn't feel final. These few tenuous threads of forgiveness that he has extended to his God, to himself. He sighs.
"Sometimes," he says, "frequently even, I think that the only thing I've learned is that there is more to learn."
"That's true," Yusuf says ponderously.
"Your Arabic is still appallingly bad, and you've had so many years to practice."
He breaks off laughing when Niccolo pushes his face away with his hand.
"Don't blame the student for the faults of the teacher."
Yusuf rolls onto his side. Niccolo mirrors him, one arm behind his back, fingers resting on his scabbard just in case. Yusuf raises one hand to stroke Niccolo's cheek, to tuck his hair back behind his ear. His fingertips leave a tingle trail on Niccolo's skin, like moonlight glimmering on unstill water.
"But I can understand the compulsion of the painter who created this."
His eyes flick to the mural on the ceiling.
"At the mosque, I appreciated the craft, the architecture, the skill that the builders and artists poured into making these buildings. But I didn't really understand it, to be filled with such a love."
He cups Niccolo's jaw. His eyes have become dark and liquid.
"Such a love that the ocean couldn't contain it, much less a human soul. And to need to have somewhere to put it, some way to communicate it, knowing you could never show the depth and the colors and the facets of your love, not if you tried for a lifetime, not for 100, but at the same time being helpless to try. No, That is something I did not understand until I met you. There is a beat where they look at one another. Then Niccolo seizes Yusuf by the collar and kisses him. Yusuf pulls him closer, sliding his hand from Niccolo's cheek through his hair, down between his shoulder blades. He makes a low noise and licks over Niccolo's teeth, a very underhanded tactic that Niccolo responds to by pressing Yusuf's shoulders back into the stones and rolling over him. "Really, Niccolo? In a church?" Yusuf murmurs, right against Niccolo's mouth, mock scandalized. "Is this the kind of thing you Catholic men find thrilling?" "If the Lord is watching," Niccolo says, "then we may as well invite him to join us." Yusuf kisses him and pauses. "I suppose he would be a very selfless lover." Niccolo scoffs. "Unlike your other lover?" "Oh, yes. My other lover is heartlessly cruel." Niccolo sits back. "Is that right?" "You see, he's not kissing me right now as he could be." Niccolo trails his hands down Yusuf's chest. He can feel Yusuf's muscles tense and relax through the linen shirt. He slides it back up to curl above Yusuf's heart. Niccolo knows Yusuf considers him to be one of those infinite things Yusuf adores, but that is not quite true. Yusuf notices Niccolo pause. "What?" "I wish I was still sure of God," Niccolo whispers, "so I could be sure of how it will be at the end of all things." They've had this conversation before, many times. "I don't want to leave you. I don't want to be left by you." Yusuf runs his hands up Niccolo's arms, comforting, and then makes a little hum that Niccolo knows he has abruptly thought of something he means to share. Niccolo waits. "Did you see the rose in the courtyard, Hayati? The wild rose?" "No," Niccolo says. He had been looking at Yusuf, storm-swept, wild. "When I saw it, I thought of you," Yusuf says, "growing through the ruins, fed by storms and lightning. But it had these tender white and yellow flowers." "Stop it," Niccolo says, trying not to color. "Is it not enough for one day?" "Never," Yusuf vows. "In 1,000 years, I'll still be making declarations like this to you." "You're intolerable," he says, knowing that Yusuf knows he means the opposite. "You're in love." "If I take off your clothes," Niccolo asks, "will that make you be quiet?" "Well," Yusuf stretches under his hands and pretends to think about it. He runs his thumb over Niccolo's slightly parted lips. "You can only try." "It's a very clever equation," Niccolo says, turning over the next page. "It's been years since it was published, but they have spent so much of the last century at sea, searching, and he's only just been able to read the treatise that has rewritten the language of natural history, or so the astronomer from the town claims." Yusuf pours Niccolo more wine and fails to look impressed. The driftwood fire licks green for a moment. Yusuf flattens his map over his knees, humming over it. Somewhere in the blackness, a few meters down the beach from them, out of the glow of the fire, he can hear the sea waves shuffling themselves onto the sand. It is a quiet, steady susurration that is perfect for reading to. Niccolo has decided he likes books. He likes them very much. He is glad there are more of them these days. They have come ashore at Malta, and Niccolo has a creeping feeling they will be going north from here. He doesn't really enjoy mathematical theorems that much, but the astronomer had been so enthusiastic after Niccolo's remark about having read Johannes Kepler, stretching the definition of red quite to breaking point and steadily not meeting Yusuf's eyes. And Niccolo got the sense that she didn't get the chance to discuss her passion for studying the heavens very often. "Now I can mathematically calculate it," Niccolo says, tracing his finger along the dense text. "Calculate what?" Yusuf asks. "The size of the gravitational force that holds me in orbit around you." Yusuf looks across at him. "It's gravity, is it?"
Must be, Niccolo says. He picks up his glass of wine and sips. The fire dances in Yusuf's eyes. Nothing else.
Nothing that comes to mind, Niccolo says.
He feels Yusuf move to sit behind him, stretching his barefooted legs out on the sand either side of Niccolo's hips. Niccolo leans back against his chest. Yusuf hooks his chin over Niccolo's shoulder and looks down at the yellow-lit pages.
See here.
Niccolo turns to the derived law. He translates slowly, because it involves him finding the word for the Latin phrase in Ligurian and then translating to Arabic. Yusuf never learned Latin to fluency, and both history and Niccolo seem to agree it is a waste of even their unlimited time.
The gravitational force is proportional to the inverse of the distance multiplied by itself. The closer we are, the stronger it is.
Yusuf says. And by an increment, even Newton would find hard to calculate, shifts closer to Niccolo.
And you can make precise computation if you know these values.
Niccolo enjoys precise things. Yusuf snags Niccolo's wine cup from his hand and tips back his head to drink. This is more than a little distracting.
And what if the distance is zero, he asks.
Then the force, Niccolo says, and has to work this time to keep his voice light, knowing that Yusuf can tell either way, becomes infinite. He holds out his hand for his wine.
Is that so? Yusuf murmurs into Niccolo's hair, voice a little low.
He returns the cup to Niccolo's hand. You know, he couldn't have done it without Abul Barakat al-Baghdadi's work on acceleration first.
Oh, not a chance, Niccolo says. Or Ibn Bajjah, for that matter.
Yusuf puts a warm hand over the inside of Niccolo's knee, and he suddenly doesn't feel like reading about mechanics anymore. He closes the book, wraps the book in canvas, and carefully sets it aside.
Now your turn. What were you reading? He asks.
I was only... Yusuf's thumb sweeps back and forth over Niccolo's kneecap, apparently mindlessly, but Niccolo knows him better. Plotting where to go from here. Here. He pats the sand next to him and Niccolo obliges, moving to sit cross-legged at Yusuf's side. Yusuf settles back onto his elbows and tilts his face up to survey the clear night sky. The firelight continues to lap at the sand. Yusuf picks out the North Star, and Niccolo's suspicions are confirmed. Some years ago, he had mentioned he may be ready to go to Liguria, that 700 years may be long enough to have been away from home, and he has felt Yusuf waiting for the right time to steer them there ever since. We can sail to the mainland at... Yusuf traces their path with his finger through the bath of stars. Niccolo watches his finger slide over the diamond, dusted night sky, and his gaze follows Yusuf's toned forearm down to where his shirt sleeves are bunched up around his bicep, the familiar curve of his shoulder, and finally alighting on the point of Yusuf's throat, moving as he describes their journey through the cities. His voice is usually mellow and light, reminding Niccolo of sunlight on a field of wheat. But tonight, it is in pitch with the hush, hush, hush of the waves on the sand. And then Yusuf turns and catches Niccolo unabashedly staring at him.
Nico, see?
You're not looking. Yusuf says, smiling crookedly.
No, Niccolo says, smiling in return.
I'm sorry, say again.
And then to Genova, says Yusuf.
Niccolo presses his face into Yusuf's shoulder.
Why?
So I can practice my Ligurian with someone who will actually critique my dialect, Yusuf says. And Niccolo thwacks him on the chest. I want to see that place that made you.
Niccolo raises his head. Malton evening light is washing over Yusuf. He looks warmly at Niccolo through dark half-moons of eyes.
Habib Albi, Niccolo says.
You are the place that made me.
By the time he takes a new name, Nicky has dispatched many, many people to the world after. He is a lover. He is a killer. He is a holy cradle of conflict and always will be. Sometimes, in the flow of a fight, when he cuts someone down, perfectly without pause, he thinks, is this what I was made to do? And sometimes when he is carrying a coughing child out of a collapsed mine, tiny hands fisted in his shirt, he thinks, this is what I was made to do. And sometimes when Joe gasps awake at night and tenses, then reaches for him, and Nicola holds Joe's face between his hands until his breathing evens, he thinks, this is what I was made to do. We've had a postcard, Nikki says, coming into the room. He holds it up to show Andy's harsh handwriting, very rough for someone who lived through the invention of the written word, to Joe, who had been lying on the bed, a stick of charcoal between his teeth, and sketchbook in one hand, the other behind his head when Nikki had left. He has since apparently given up on activity of any kind and is sitting in the low hotel room chair, legs stretched out and crossed at the ankle, face turned up towards the ceiling. Nikki does not blame him. It is very, very hot in Malta. The afternoon sun pools on the floor of the hotel room. The ceiling fan spins lazily and rather ineffectually above. Joe has done away with wearing a shirt. A necessity, but, Nikki thinks, also an improvement. Hmm? Joe says, raising his head, squinting. Yes, she asked to meet us in Bruges in 1 month. Nikki sets it on the table. He slides into Joe's lap. Joe allows his head to slowly tip back again. Nikki trails his fingers over Joe's neck, where Joe's skin is shining slightly. Joe's hands, warm, well-worn, come to rest on Nikki's waist. I've gone soft, Joe mumbles, eyes still closed. Nikki's fingers pause in the slightly damp curls at the base of Joe's skull. Never, Nikki says. He leans forward slowly, resting his forehead in the hollow junction between Joe's neck and shoulder. He smells good. Nikki kisses the point of his collarbone. He feels mellifluous, soft, yielding. I swear it wasn't this warm when we met, Joe says. He's begun to trace something with his fingertips over Nikki's spine. It was, Nikki says. He turns his head, his nose brushing against Joe's neck. He tilts his chin up. It's been warm ever since. He kisses the salt dew stretch of Joe's neck under the point of his jaw. Joe draws in a breath. Nikki feels it shuddering in his chest where they are leaning together. It's strange, completely unreasonable, how he can still get a little touch drunk on Joe. It's been 900 years, but occasionally the feeling of skin on skin softly melts every one of his muscle fibers, making his head feel pleasantly heavy. He allows the friction of soft skin to catch his lower lip on Joe's beautiful throat, allows it to drag a little. Joe breathes. Darling. Nikki lets his lower teeth scrape just lightly over Joe's pulse point. Joe's fingers tighten over Nikki's hip bone so fractionally someone else might not notice. He knows other people consider Joe to be guarded under his effusive smiles, but they don't know him like Nikki does. Nikki sees feeling going right through him from nerve ending to nerve ending, ceaseless, unpausing, an arc of pure light. See? He kisses over Joe's jugular, the same place on Nikki that he had touched for the first time ever lifetimes ago. Nikki feels rather than sees Joe smile. You're going to be the death of me. You're hilarious, Nikki says, but he's smiling, and Joe hooks his arms under Nikki's thighs and carries them to bed. The end.